You're listening to the Apple Insider Podcast.
Welcome to this, the 75th Diamond Jubilee episode of the Apple Insider Podcast. I'm your host, Victor Marks, and joining me is Apple Insider's editor-in-chief, Neil Hughes.
Hey, Victor, how's it going?
It's fantastic. How are you?
I'm all right.
That's kind of a letdown. You're brilliant.
Always.
I know it. So let's begin. I wanted to begin by talking a little bit about, I wanted to talk about the rumors.
Let's do rumors.
Well, we had a bunch of things, right? We had iPhone, we had display stuff and things like that. But first of all, you've been running the beta version of iOS 10.
I have.
You're on beta 1, is that right?
Yes, unfortunately.
Why is there no beta 2?
That's a good question. It's going to be coming up on 3 weeks next week since the launch of beta 1. Typically, Apple it would do a 2-week gap in between releases. And I think that was the expectation that we would see a new beta either on Monday or Tuesday of this week. And so we do not have one. And that pains me a very great deal because in order to do my day job, I have to be running iOS 10 and watchOS 3 on my devices, and they are buggy, and you should not be running them. Anyone who is not doing this for a living, who writes about Apple, should not be running the beta software on their main phone because this is meant for developers for testing. Unfortunately, I don't have a spare Apple Watch, and if I want to continue wearing my Apple Watch, then I have to be connected to a phone running iOS 10, so I'm carrying both with me everywhere and dealing with a lot of crashes. We do not yet have a beta 2, but hopefully next week.
Well, I know you're looking forward to it. I wisely have chosen to not run the betas this time, so
that is a wise decision. As much as I like the change in iOS 10 and watchOS 3, they're both fantastic, not for general public consumption.
Well, you remember that every time I've tried a new release, right, whether it was the iOS 8 betas or the iOS 9 betas, I have encountered bizarre problems that no one can explain.
I know, and I can say that I had a bizarre problem that has lasted since iOS 7 with copy and paste not working properly. And I don't know what the heck happened, but installing iOS 10 beta fixed copy and paste. It actually works properly for me now. So
hallelujah.
That alone is quite an accomplishment and almost makes the issues of the beta worth it for me.
Well, I am glad to hear that your long time suffering is at an end.
Indeed.
What I'm at a loss for is how this issue persisted across so many different phones and releases for you. It's probably something corrupt inside your iCloud backup that's killing it.
Yeah, it must be. I have no idea. This phone was not a fresh install. It was a over-the-air install of beta 10, and it fixed it. And I have no idea why. But again, this persisted over phones and OS releases and everything. And I continue to have an issue where I would copy something, go to another app, hit paste, and it would paste something not that I had copied something from prior. And then I would have to go back and hit copy again, sometimes a third time. So I am extremely thankful that it has apparently been fixed with iOS 10. And I've Googled it in many attempts to fix it and found that other people were having similar problems. So hopefully this is something that Apple quietly fixed in the new release that will fix that issue for everybody else that was experiencing it.
Cool. Now, let me talk about this for a second, because I, as you know, I'm a fan of all things historical, including technology history, right?
Right.
And if you've been watching my Twitter feed, you've seen that I've been posting things under the hashtag Computer Museum lately.
Mm-hmm.
I have been digging through, and I have been unearthing crazy, crazy old stuff in terms of technology. And we wrote an article about how the iPhone is turning 9 this year,
mm-hmm.
right? So, first of all, did you write that article?
I did.
What was in it? Tell us for it, because you wrote it. You can tell us best.
Well, it was just kind of how the iPhone is at a crossroads right now. And it was a little bit of a history lesson as to what happened with the first generation iPhone and some of the mistakes that were made that Apple course corrected in some cases, like adjusting the pricing almost immediately. And some a little more over time, such as well, the addition of copy and paste, for example, took a little while. The App Store didn't launch for another year, but it was just kind of putting all that in perspective for where Apple is now, having just come off of their first ever quarter with year-over-year decline in iPhone sales, where obviously the iPhone is an astronomical success and continues to be, especially if you're not someone who's focused on growth and just looking at the dollars and cents of it. The iPhone is a cash printing machine for Apple. So, you know, it's an interesting place where Apple's at right now, where if the company wants to stimulate growth and return to growth, what are they going to do to make that happen as we're kind of on the cusp of the launch of the so-called iPhone 7, which is expected to look largely like the iPhone 6S? Just kind of talking about those things that Apple did in the beginning, like the $200 price cut 2 months after it launched, to address some of the issues that they had right out of the gate. You know, it's easy for people to forget that the first iPhone, which came out in 2007, June of 2007, so we just celebrated the anniversary
June
on the
29th, 2007.
The first iPhone only sold like 6 million units in its entire lifetime, that first generation model. I mean, 6 million units is nothing today. Like, Apple sells that many phones in a couple weeks.
Yeah, and everyone considers that a failure these days.
Yeah, we're talking about a year's worth of sales after they finally replaced it with the iPhone 3G. But that
let's put some perspective on that, right? What the landscape at the time was that before the iPhone, mobile phones were either dumb phones or feature phones, as we call them today.
Right.
You know, the hottest phone back then, the phone that everyone wanted to have back then, was the Motorola Razr.
Yes.
Which was
at the top of the heap for years. I mean, it was not as quickly evolving of an industry back then as it is now, certainly.
It's not exactly. I mean, there were definitely revolutions in terms of what you were able to do back then. Things like the Nokia Symbian S60 series, where it was a smartphone platform, and you could totally run applications from the Nokia App Store on it, or the Sony versions that were UIQ, which was similar. There were definitely smartphones out there, and I'm not even mentioning BlackBerry or Moto Q.
But I mean, think about Windows Mobile 2002, 2003,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then think about how little it had changed by 2007 when the iPhone came out. I mean, color. I had a Windows Mobile 2003 device that was color. Yeah. It was a Dell Axum PDA.
I remember that.
That platform really did not evolve in that span from 2003 when the OS shipped until like 2007 when the iPhone came out. Really was still looking the same, was still a start button based interface, stylus based interface. I mean, and to put that in perspective, think about the iPhone. Here we are in 2016. Wait. Think about 4 years ago what your iPhone was like.
Wait. Just because I want to go back to Palm for a second. Because Palm was the originator of a lot of this, right? Palm was the original pocket assistant. Palm was the first stylus-based. And the whole Palm interface was predicated on copying Macintosh System 6 or 7, basically.
But Windows Mobile was the market leader at that time.
Well, so here's an interesting piece that I wanted to bring up, is that if you remember in 2005, so Palm had this history, and our own Daniel Aaron Dilger wrote about this years ago at Roughly Drafted. Palm had this history of being the hardware and software company and then selling off the software and being just the hardware,
right,
and licensing the software back from the other company. And they did this off and on repeatedly. And the benefit of doing it like this was that the software company could license the Palm OS out to Sony, Qualcomm, Kyocera, and others, and therefore there would be more Palm OS devices. And the last time they did this exercise, Access bought the software, bought the OS, mm-hmm. and was giving them a hard time about doing it because Palm had bought a BOS and was going to run BOS. And we were going to have our first true multi-threaded, multitasking smartphone via Palm running BOS. That future never came to be because Access said, if you do that, we will no longer license you the Palm OS. And by the way, we're going to stop licensing the Palm OS and you're going to have to pick up Linux from us. And it's going to be Access Linux on Palm. Mm-hmm. And so their answer was a screw me, screw you move where they said, we will license in Windows Mobile. And they sold half of the Palm Trios with Palm OS and the other half with Windows Mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this was happening in January of 2007.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget that the best phone OS you could get at that time was HTC Sense was doing their own skin over Windows
Mobile. Oh, the Diamond interface.
Which was basically saying Windows Mobile is terrible. It's not finger-friendly. You need a stylus. It uses a start button. It's a nightmare. Let's
Well, the problem with the HTC interface was that it was beautiful for about the first layer and a half. Right. And as soon as you tried to do anything, you were dumped right back into Windows Mobile.
And that's one of the problems that, you know, still persists on many Android devices to this day. I mean, not every company has the resources of Samsung, and even Samsung is not really a software company. But you end up with these, you know, unique user interfaces on Android that lead to inconsistencies within the platform.
Yeah, well, Google would rather you that you didn't do that at all. They would rather you just ship stock Android and deal with it.
Right, but you're not going to be able to stop Samsung from doing that because they have to differentiate their phones. So what was once a problem continues to be a problem, just different companies and the names have changed. But if you look back on that and how stagnant the smartphone industry was before the iPhone came in, it took a little while, and certainly until the iPhone 3G hit, for things to really start to accelerate they did.
I don't think it was stagnant at all. There were a lot of interesting attempts at doing things, but they were all within a well-boundaried sort of space, right? You know, there were the Nokia S40 phones that were music players also. There were the Sony Walkman phones that were music players, like the Walkman 880. There were a number of attempts at doing things to differentiate from what phones had been.
Clearly you're nostalgic for this era, but those phones were all garbage.
Some of them were actually quite good, but none of them were as interesting or good as the first iPhone.
Right. The iPhone was a paradigm changer, without question. And you got to remember, too, back then, nobody owned a smartphone. Nobody had a data plan. They were expensive. I mean, now you're looking at, you know, most
people. I had GPRS data, and I had a Nokia. I had a couple of different
Nokia Symbian phones. You are not most people, Victor. You are an early adopter enthusiast. Your mom did not own a Windows phone smartphone or Palm or anything like that.
My dad had the Kyocera Palm phone. Mm-hmm. And before that, and after that, he had the Handspring Trio phone with the smartphone module.
And was his company paying for it, or was he buying it himself?
IBM paid for at least one of those.
Yeah. I mean, people weren't buying smartphones the way they are now. You know, most phone sales now of all phones are smartphones. Remember back, you know, Nokia was the worldwide leader.
Oh, the communicator. Do you remember the communicator?
Nokia controlled 90% of the smartphone market up until like 2010 when things really started to shift globally. But for those first few years of the iPhone, smartphones were still a very small share of the overall mobile phone business. Certainly in the years since. Yeah, certainly in the years since, it's changed quite a bit. But really, the iPhone was the tipping point in so many ways, in terms of accessibility, in terms of demand, in terms of adoption. Without the iPhone, the iPhone literally changed the entire world of computing and technology.
You have your first iPhone.
I bought my first iPhone in September of 2007, the day that Apple announced the price drop. So
you still have it?
I do. I was a very poor newspaper reporter at the time. And
repeat yourself.
They announced the price drop, and I was a T-Mobile customer at the time. So I might if T-Mobile.
So you had to jailbreak to be able to get it to work on T-Mobile.
I had to go to an AT&T store because technically it was a subsidized phone. So there was a weird thing where AT&T wanted to set it up in the store because Apple wanted them to do it to make sure that everything was good. But then they backed off of that because because the activation servers were crashing. So they just let people start taking their phones home.
So here's what happened originally, right? I bought it on day one, and the way that I bought it on day one was that I couldn't handle waiting in line. So I had a friend who lived in Oregon and waited in line in Oregon and then shipped it to me overnight after he waited in line and got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was in Portland, I think, and or somewhere outside Beaverton, who knows. And he shipped me the iPhone, and I had it the next day, basically. And when the price drop hit, which, as you said, was September, mm-hmm. I bought it in June. Price drop happened in September. They gave out
$100
gift cards, gift cards to everyone. And those gift cards came in great useful for many, many users, because when it came time for the 3G, people who had that gift card ready used it to go towards the purchase of the 3G.
Yeah, except you paid $200 more than the phone was worth 2 months later. So,
But you had it. You had
so the when they launched the there was an 8 gig model that sold for $600, and there was a 4 gig model that sold for $500. Yes. Both of them launched on June 29th. In September, Apple cut the price by $200 and basically discontinued the 4 gig, sold the remaining inventory. That day that it was announced was also about the same time that they had first jailbroken the iPhone. So I knew that I could run it on T-Mobile. I was not a AT&T customer, and since it was a subsidized phone, you technically had to be an AT&T customer to buy the
Well,
phone.
It was SIM-locked.
I went into a AT&T store. They wanted to activate it. I told them that I was buying it for a gift for somebody and that they would bring it back. So yes, I lied to the AT&T store. Somebody come get me. And then because I couldn't afford a data plan on you know the prices well, that they had at that time, I had
the AT&T data plan you were going to get was the unlimited data plan at that time.
Well, it was expensive and I couldn't afford it. So
Mikey
still
has his unlimited data plan grandfathered from that time.
I was on T-Mobile and I hacked it to run, and then I had a T-Mobile WAP, a WAP plan, mm-hmm. which basically allowed limited internet, but there was a jailbreak install that you could do. It wasn't what it later became with like their own app store and stuff. Like you had to do everything kind of coded by hand with the, you know, tutorials online. But
yeah, Cydia was not originally an app store. It became one.
Right. So I had to hack it so that it would reroute all internet traffic through the single port that T-Mobile allowed. Because it turned out that T-Mobile at the time when they were selling these, it was like, I think it was $3 a month for data. And it was slow as hell. But
First of all data at that time was, right? You were using GPRS.
Right. So they weren't checking the type of data that was going through. So you would forward all data through a specific port, and then the phone worked. You could browse the web on the go. You could the only thing you couldn't get when I did that was visual voicemail. But everything else
Well, that's because T-Mobile didn't run visual voicemail servers at that time.
Right. It was an AT&T exclusive. It required their servers and all that. But other than that, the phone worked great, and I kept it for until the iPhone 4 came out. So I stuck around with the OG iPhone for a long time. And that was actually – I got the iPhone 4 because I just started working at Apple Insider. And so that was the only reason that I had upgraded at that point was I kind of had to. But prior to that, you know, just in terms of trying to save money and being a poor reporter at a newspaper, that was how I scratched by.
Nice. I had the iPhone that I bought on day one, and I was at Macworld when it was announced. I was at Macworld again the year later when iOS 2 was announced. Now, early on, there was no App Store, and maps were not turn by turn with the use of the GPS. They were sort of assisted GPS, and you could step through the steps on the turns, but it wouldn't recognize where you were and adjust the turns for you at that time.
Right.
And there, like I said, there was no App Store. You had the apps that were there, and you had the internet. You had Safari.
Yep. And web apps.
Web apps. And they were surprisingly capable. You could do a lot with them. You know, OpenGL let you do cool transforms where you could do animations to flip cards kind of thing and really make the web app feel like a native app in a lot of ways.
Right.
It was really cool. And the you know beauty of that is, okay, fine, you're using the network resource to pull it down, but it could store it in some cache on the phone, and that you always had the app up to date. You never had to worry about updates. You always had... You know, it was either available or it wasn't, and it was going to be great because there was no worry about viruses or other vulnerabilities. And it was just its own thing. But the outcry and the hackers and people like Erica Sadoun, who is a developer who used to work for TUAW, the unofficial Apple weblog when it was a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, she wrote about, along with people like Craig Hockenberry, who behind Icon Factory and Twitterific, they wrote about how to unofficially write applications for the iPhone at that time.
And people made really cool jailbroken applications before you could install, app before there was an app store.
Right, using the work laid down by Sadoun and Hockenberry.
There was actually one app that was kind of mind-blowing at the time. It's funny to look back and be like, you know, who cares? Whoa. But one of the early demos for the Microsoft Surface, not the Surface that we know now, but...
No, the coffee table.
The coffee table, which was announced before the iPhone or around the same time. One of the demos they had was a series of photos laying on a table, and they were like kind of stacking them and resizing them and moving them around. And so someone made an app for the iPhone before there was an app store on Cydia that you could install. That was, you could take photos from your collection and move them around on the screen and resize them and put them in front of each other and stuff like that. And I remember showing that to people, and like, it blew their mind because it was using multi-touch and there were all these items on the screen at once, and the screen was essentially just a blank canvas to do something with. And it's funny to look back and realize, you know, how silly that was.
Today, that would be a technology demo, not an app.
Right. But, you know, at the time, that was like, you know, especially when you were thinking about Microsoft Surface and it was this giant table and all that stuff, like, this was something in your pocket that was doing that exact same capability. It was really quite incredible.
Well, so the original BlackBerry quote was, one of the founders of BlackBerry got an iPhone and took it apart, and his response was, "My God, they somehow shrunk down and shoved a Mac inside a phone." And that was literally what we'd arrived at. Yeah, I still have my original iPhone. I think I have two iPhone 3Gs hanging around right now, maybe three of them.
I think the greatest testament you could give to the original iPhone is how many of the design principles not only remain in the current iPhone in terms of where everything's located and how it works, et cetera, but also in how Apple has revisited them and come back to them over the years. For example, the iPhone 3G went with the plastic back, the iPhone 4 switched to a glass back, and they kept those sharp edges on the 4 and the 5 and the 5S. But now you look at the iPhone.
Wait, look at your Apple Watch in profile and look at your original iPhone.
Right. Now look at your iPhone 5S, or I'm sorry, look at your iPhone 6S and your iPhone 6. Metal back, curved edges, a very, very, very similar design to the first iPhone when you break it down in that way. Obviously not as thin and not as elegant.
No, but your Apple Watch is every bit as thick.
Yeah, it is. So, it's interesting to look back and realize how much foresight Apple had in the design of the iPhone, in something that was not only iconic, but that could last. And you could pick up an iPhone right now, and I have my original classic iPhone, and when I feel it in my hand, it just feels right. It's well constructed. It's thick, but I mean, honestly, if they sold a phone like that right now that had like a great camera and a thick battery that would last a couple days, I'd probably buy it.
They've come a long way.
Maybe a 10th generation iPhone next year, right?
Yeah. You know, I've been digging through and posting things, like I said, on Twitter, and I found the all of the Mac magazines from back then, the Mac World and some of the others, Mac User, from the announcement of the original iPhone with the first one on the cover story.
At Mac World, yeah.
Yeah. It's, the first question is, why on earth did I save all that stuff? But the second thing is it's really, like you say, it's interesting to look back at what has been.
Mm-hmm.
And where we've been. And I still, you know, Mikey laughs at me for this, but at time to time I power on the iPhone 3G and the original iPhone. And some of the apps are still able to work. You know, the servers that they talked to for things on the internet are still there, and in some cases still alive and still talking the same language. Now, a lot of that's going to change real soon because iOS 10 requires HTTPS for all connections. So I fully expect that many of the things that I was using on those old iPhones are pretty much dead.
I think the last OS you can install is 3.1.2 on the first iPhone. I think that's the most up-to-date it can be.
That's correct. And 3.1, 3, and 4 were allowed on the 3G.
I actually, after I got my iPhone 4 and still my old iPhone hanging around, because I like to do fun stuff with technology just for the heck of it. I did a hack where I installed Android on my first gen iPhone. And there was also a mod on Cydia that took iOS 4 features and ported them back to 3.1.2.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. One of these days, I'm going to try and roll back my original iPhone to iOS 1.0, or rather iPhone OS 1.0. And I have the, you know, I have the original Apple TV, right? And I've rolled that, the hot plate, and I've rolled that back to Apple TV OS 1. And I actually then had to use it. I had a requirement where I actually had to use it. So I had to go ahead and update it to Apple TV OS 2 to be able to use it again. And the nice thing about the current version of iTunes, you know, it's kind of incredible. Here we are in 2016, and iTunes 12 is able to talk to the original Apple TV.
Who says Apple doesn't offer legacy support?
They totally offer legacy support. And it updated and it synchronized the movies that I had to have on it. So here's what I was doing. I know all of our listeners think I'm nuts and wish I would move on to something interesting. I promise I will. But I had a movie that had been edited in iMovie for an event, and there were a series of projectors on a wall pointing at different screens that had come down motorized, and I needed something that could run the movie reliably on demand, and I didn't want to use a laptop because laptops have 1,000 things that can go wrong.
Right.
And so I couldn't do it with a modern Apple TV because the modern Apple TV, even though it has storage, doesn't really have a way to save movies to it locally that I could think of. Someone's going to tell me that I'm wrong, that there's an app for that and everything, and I appreciate it if they do. But at the time, I couldn't think of how the answer was. But the original Apple TV was essentially an iPod with an HDMI port on it and synced the same way. And so I loaded the current new 2016 movie onto the 2007 Apple TV, connected it to the port in the wall that ran the projectors in the ceiling, and used the infrared remote to press play. And it just worked, which is just what it should do.
That's pretty cool.
It was excellent. The event went off without a hitch.
That's awesome.
Brilliant. So we talked about that. You know, a couple weeks ago, we were talking before WWDC about how Apple was going to make a display, and it was going to have Thunderbolt, and it was going to have an external graphic unit in it. And we were totally wrong.
Well, I didn't think they were going to do that. That was just a rumor that was out there. What happened was WWDC came and passed, and not only did they not release one, but they also, the week after WWDC, discontinued the Thunderbolt display. It is no more. They are no longer, they're selling their available inventory, and then that's it. Now, according to yet another rumor, Apple is still working on the supposed model with an integrated graphics card. And as we've discussed before, this makes sense for a variety of reasons, but the biggest one is if you were to invest in a 12-inch MacBook, which is underpowered to allow for its thin design and battery life, you couldn't drive all the pixels on a big monitor, which is a problem. That would limit Apple's ability to sell that, especially as they're pushing for thinner and lighter devices. So the expectation is that Apple is going to release a new Thunderbolt display that is going to have an integrated graphics card in the display itself that will act as an external graphics card for a MacBook, MacBook Pro, whatever. This is technically possible and has been done with Macs and is currently being done commercially on Windows PCs because the speed of Thunderbolt is fast enough that it actually has the bandwidth to allow a graphics card to work externally. Now, I wouldn't expect this external graphics card capability to be some sort of super-powered gaming rig. I think this is more about just driving the pixels on a Retina display for a 27-inch Thunderbolt Retina display. I don't see this turning into, you know, some high-end GeForce GTX graphics card.
We're not playing Crysis or Warcraft,
right,
or whatever.
You're not going to be buying this machine for Half-Life 3 if it ever comes out. So,
oh, come on.
I wish. I am a former PC gamer, I guess is the way I would put it. I used to build
recovering, if you will.
I just don't have the space and the time, really. Building a Windows PC was a lot of fun for somebody like myself who's nerdy and likes working with gadgets, and I liked upgrading the components, and you know, it was a lot of time, and back then I had a lot of time on my hands, you know, and you're counting frame rates and checking temperatures and doing all that kind of stuff, and it was fun. But nowadays, if I want a game, I'm mostly playing games on my TV just because it's easier, because you just kind of plug it in and it works.
So wait, why not Steambox?
You know, I thought about it. PC games with controllers are not something that, you know, Valve has done a pretty good job with their big picture mode to try to address that. But there's still something about using a game console where it's just designed for that so-called lean back experience with a controller. That does not work as well on PC games. Now, having said that, if I could get a high-end graphics card and plug it into my Mac over Thunderbolt, or buy a monitor with an integrated graphics card that was, you know, or have something that was swappable even potentially, I'd be all over that. I would, if I had to, you know, God forbid, boot camp, dual boot Windows on my Mac, and be able to play PC games that I currently cannot play, that I'm missing out on because of, you know, being only Mac. But I just don't have the space to build a PC tower, and I don't really have the motivation to buy a Steam box. You know, maybe if Half-Life 3 ever launches or something, I would do that. But what I am hoping is, because realistically, let's be honest, this Thunderbolt display with graphics card is not going to have a high-end graphics card. It'll be enough to push the pixels, which is fine. That's what Apple wants it for. What would be nice to see is if Apple uses its launch as an opportunity to allow third-party manufacturers to introduce their own Thunderbolt graphics cards to market for official support for OS X, and not just some hack being put together as it is right now. And so if I, as somebody who maybe wants to push pixels, get some more power, not even for gaming, like just running Final Cut Pro and stuff like that, to be able to take a small 12-inch MacBook and dock it and have it turn into a super powerful workstation at home, and then be able to take it on the go and have nice portability and battery life.
Let's temper that a little bit, right? Super powerful in terms of the graphics card that would be attached to it. The processor can remain the processor inside.
True. That is true. Yes.
It doesn't magically become a Core i7.
No, but it would greatly enhance the ability of it to do things like edit video. The exporting of the video tends to be more CPU intensive, so that would probably still be pretty slow. But in terms of transferring the video files and that sort of thing, and you could make that a much more efficient experience with Thunderbolt and docking it and turning it into something more powerful. And we've talked about this with the iPad too, right? This ability to turn your personal computing device into the device that you need at that moment. If you need an ultra portable laptop, you got it. If you need more of a workstation, you can do it.
Love that smart connector.
I think that, well, it doesn't even have to be a smart connector. It could be Lightning. It could be USB-C in the case of the 12-inch MacBook. Whatever it's done over, we have the bandwidth and the technology now to get the best of both worlds with these devices. You don't have to make those kinds of sacrifices. You don't have to make those kinds of compromises. And so it would be nice to see if OS X offers some sort of official support for that with third-party manufacturers to allow me to maybe put a high-end GeForce graphics card connected to my Mac and have it work.
So what do you think the likelihood is of this rumor coming true?
It came from John Pitchkowski, formerly of All Things D, now known as Recode. He's at BuzzFeed of all places now. He has a pretty good track record on this stuff. So I went from not thinking it was going to happen to thinking it's probably going to happen, and I'm excited. Even if it is not a high-end gaming thing and it just pushes the pixels, to have that option to be able to have a super portable laptop and then dock it with a gorgeous 27-inch Retina display, that's awesome. If you care at all about this kind of stuff, if technology excites you, that's really, really cool.
So in the meantime, there is no Apple display. They're selling out whatever stock they have on hand, which, knowing that they manage stock well, is probably not much.
Right.
Can we talk about the best alternatives so that our dear listeners who are actually going out and buying monitors know what to get?
Yeah, you have a lot of options out there. There's a lot of 4K and 5K displays that you can get, and they're pretty reasonably priced. I mean, if you think about Apple's Thunderbolt display, it was like $1,000.
Right. So a Dell UltraSharp 27-inch, the U2717D Infinity Edge monitor is...
You get that for $500.
Yeah, Amazon 510.
Yeah. I mean, that's half the price of a Thunderbolt display, and it's the same size at 27 inches. So, and that's, you know, that's not a 4K one, though. That's a...
It's a, what is it? It's 2560 by 1440.
Yeah, that's not 4K.
Okay. Well, let's keep going then.
Yeah.
The
There's a 32 Dell inch. 40,
I was going to go for the 43 inch next.
That's, yeah, that's pretty big though. We have a roundup on Apple Insider for people that are curious. There's an Asus 32 inch 4K. That's 4K. It's $990.
But it's $990. Yeah.
Still cheaper than a Thunderbolt display was.
Okay. What about the LG, the ultra wide?
I mean, if you really want a screen that wide, I wouldn't really be interested in something like that, but certainly that is an option.
Well, it's a 21:9 ratio, and the 21:9 aspect ratio is a movie theater aspect ratio.
Yeah, and it has two Thunderbolt 2.0 ports on it, which is pretty awesome, and it has USB 3 for quick charging too, so...
And it's cheaper than the other. I mean, it's $787.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember the Thunderbolt display that Apple discontinued was not a Retina display. This was not the 5K iMac display that Apple's been using for the last year. So,
right.
You know, the comparable standard resolution displays like that Dell 27-inch UltraSharp for $500, it's a pretty good deal. It's comparable. I mean, it does not have the design of the Thunderbolt display, which is admittedly gorgeous, although... thick by modern standards and heavy, but a really nice, nicely designed piece of equipment that Apple had. And hopefully, you know, when we get something later this year, it's along those same lines, you know, thin and really great panel. I would imagine they'd use the same 5K panel that's in the 27-inch iMac.
Let's we posted on our site a picture of a purported iPhone 7 enclosure,
mm-hmm.
right? The case back. And the shot that we had that I saw showed the lightning port in the middle and speaker grill holes on one side and speaker grill holes on the other side of that lightning port.
Yeah.
What does it mean? What does it all mean?
I mean, my guess is either one of the speaker grill holes on the left side serves as a mic or all of them serve as a mic. And it's just an aesthetic change. I can't see a lot of benefit to stereo sound on an iPhone. Particularly on the bottom of it when it's held in portrait mode.
Dude, I want speakers in four corners on the phone, and I want it to be like the iPad Pro, but mini.
I mean, I guess you could do that. I don't really see the point, but I think that that's just an aesthetic change that they want to do. Getting rid of the headphone jack, it just looks cleaner to have the same holes on each side of the lightning port. But I wouldn't read too much into it. You know, I had a friend ask me about it the other day and saying, what are they going to do with the space now that they got rid of the iPhone jack? And I'm like, I don't know, put another speaker there. And he's like, well, what's the point? Like, the people that are focusing on that are missing the point. The additional speakers are not why they're getting rid of the headphone jack.
They're getting rid of the headphone jack because?
Because it's a legacy item that Apple wants to encourage the death of, and it allows for thinner phones.
I was going to go with the latter half of that answer. It chews up space that could otherwise be used for more cool stuff.
Right. That's really what it comes down to.
Traditionally in iPhones, the batteries have been rectangular in shape.
Correct.
With squared off corners, basically. And we know that for the MacBook, they have been, and even for some of the MacBook Pros for a little while, they've been making their own battery cells that are layered in such a way that they take advantage of even the curved space so that there's really no room left for air. It's just battery.
Right.
Right. So by getting rid of that port, they now have more space.
In theory.
Battery potential.
In theory.
in theory.
People don't realize, yes, the phones are getting thinner, but the batteries in many cases on new phones are actually larger than they were before because the components inside the phone are so much smaller. The things that used to take up a lot of space, like the memory and the processor and all that stuff, are now actually much smaller components. They're built smaller, they're more efficient, they're cooler, and so therefore there's more space in there to put in a battery.
Well, let's talk about this for a second. So on the original iPhone, I have a bad habit of taking apart iPhones.
Right.
The original iPhone, I haven't done it in a little while, but the original iPhone, the battery was about a little larger than the size of a compact flash card. Or another way of thinking of it is if you took a deck of cards and you took out a playing card and cut it in half, splitting it right down the center vertically, you know, so that it was you had two horizontal halves.
Yeah.
Right. It was about that size. And the rest of it, the top part, was all phone motherboard. A strip down the left was all phone motherboard. Mm-hmm. And at the bottom was the antenna and the home button and speaker and mic package.
Right.
Right. And that was pretty consistent with some changes through the 3GS. The 3GS was a little easier to disassemble. The 3GS was a more elongated battery and more of the and sort of the progression of this over time was that the motherboard became a strip of printed circuit card that ran pretty much down the left side of things, and the battery grew taller and the battery grew wider over time.
And now,
and so we're left with a phone where you just have a very thin strip of a printed circuit card and a lot of battery.
And that's the same across Apple's product lines. You take apart a 12-inch MacBook, you take apart any iPad, any iPhone, and it's mm-hmm. basically all battery in there. And that is a testament to how far the rest of our technology has come and how not far our battery technology has come.
Well, true. And I'm very hopeful that our battery technology keeps going.
Somebody one day is going to come through with a major breakthrough in battery technology, and they're going to be the richest person on Earth.
It'll happen.
Hopefully. Pray
it. It'll happen. So there are a number of vendors out there that are suppliers for parts for the iPhone. And I'm thinking of TSMC, who we know make the processor chips for the iPhone. Mm-hmm. Samsung, who've made processor chips, have made memory, have supplied the displays. And in this case, I think the rumor is that they're supplying the OLED display.
Yeah, everybody's gearing up for an OLED display for next year's iPhone, not this year's.
It sounds to me that all these suppliers are banking on their revenue from the iPhone 7. They're basically counting on the iPhone 7 to keep them in the black. Is that right?
Well, you're conflating two different things.
I've got a couple of different stories going on there, but I was thinking about the TSMC story.
Yeah, first. So, I mean, everybody's ramping up for the iPhone 7, as it's known colloquially at least. That is supposed to launch in September. And, you know, there's a hope that you'll definitely get the seasonal spike in sales with a new product launch. But there's hope that it will be able to return to growth, as we kind of talked about earlier, and outperform the iPhone's success. But separately, Sharp, which is now owned by Foxconn, and Samsung, which are both key display suppliers for Apple, have been ramping up OLED production in anticipation of a new design for the iPhone in 2017, which is expected to have an all-glass chassis and an OLED display, among many other changes.
I mean, I have a report here saying that TSMC is forecasting to grow revenues by 20% in third quarter.
Yeah, they're gearing
they're
up
doing that
chip production.
Because they think an A10 is coming.
Yeah, they're gearing up chip production. They're getting back in the game. TSMC was an exclusive chip builder a few years ago for Apple. That changed as they couldn't necessarily meet the demands that Apple had with growing products. So Samsung kind of edged their way back into the chip production business. And so
The rumor here is that TSMC is going to be the exclusive for most or all of the A10 orders.
That's the rumor. We'll see how it plays out. You never really know. And it's certainly possible that Samsung stays in there. I mean, let's not, you know, for as much as our listeners and readers of Apple Insider don't like Samsung for being a competitor to Apple, they're also one of the largest chip making companies on the planet, capable of producing the capacity of ARM-based processors for Apple.
Is there any practical reason, not just emotional or otherwise, but is there a practical reason for preferring a phone with one chip in it versus the other from the supplier?
From Apple's perspective?
From a user's perspective, the A10 from TSMC or the A9 or whatever it is.
Oh, don't go down this road. There was a thing last year with the A9 processor where people found that if it was built by TSMC or Samsung, there was a different level of different power level for each one. One was more powerful than the other, but that was with a benchmark test. It wasn't with real world performance. There are going to be slight variances in parts coming from different suppliers in every facet of the iPhone: camera, screen, processor. The overall experience is supposed to be nearly identical and seamless from phone to phone, depending on the user. Some people got really worked up over where they had the TSMC chip or the Samsung chip last year because of benchmark reports, but that was nonsense. In terms of actual real world performance, it's exactly the same.
Thank you. So we talked about Samsung gearing up OLED production. Is there anything we forgot to say about that?
No, Samsung and Sharp are the ones gearing up.
Okay. And Flexium?
Yeah, I mean, suppliers are gearing up for the next iPhone that's seasonal.
Supplier's going to supply.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on with Spotify? I mean, do you use Spotify, first of all?
I use Spotify's free account because I prefer to buy my music. I don't rent it, so I'll sample something on Spotify. And then if I like the album, I'll either buy it on iTunes, or if I really like it, I'll buy it on vinyl and get a digital download code with it.
Okay. So we ran a story that says that Spotify is bumping up against the App Store, that they want to issue an update, and that they're being told that they cannot update the app because it would compete with Apple Music.
They want...
Or at least that's what they said. Go into this, unpack this for me a little bit.
Nobody really knows what the app update has, but the presumption is that they're giving people a link to go to their website to sign up for Spotify so that they save $3. Apple takes 30% cut of all sales on the App Store, including in-app purchases and subscriptions. That will soon change slightly, where if you have a subscription over a year long, then the Apple's cut will drop to 15%. However, Spotify charges $13 per month for new users who sign up through their app on the iPhone, and the reason for the higher price is solely because of Apple's 30% cut. If you were to go to Spotify's website or sign up through their app on the Mac or something like that, you would pay $10 a month instead of $13. So they're raising a stink, saying it's unfair that Apple takes a 30% cut of all subscriptions through their app on the iPhone. They don't think Apple's policy is fair. So they claim that they tried to push through an update to their app the other day, and it was rejected by Apple because of their rules for in-app purchases. So the only thing I can guess is they probably included a link to leave the app, go to the website, and save $3, which Apple does not allow. They sent a letter to Apple. They leaked it to the press. They gave it to members of Congress. They're raising a stink, saying that Apple is engaged in anti-competitive practices to keep Apple Music cheaper to sign up for than Spotify.
Right. Now, this is not the first time that the App Store has used this reasoning that you cannot compete against a built-in app.
It used to be that Apple did not allow you to charge less outside of the App Store. You had to have pricing parity so that, you know, you wouldn't be able to, for example, go through the website and, you know, save money that way, or they wanted to make sure that everything was priced the same, and then they would still get their 30% cut. They eventually backed off of that, and so now that's why you can see Spotify charging $3 more on iPhone than they do elsewhere.
Right. I'm thinking back to the days where some of Google's apps were not updated for a long period of time because Apple was rejecting the updates.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the VoIP apps, things like that.
There were some issues with Apple had policies about replicating the core functions of the phone. So they didn't like apps that allowed you to make calls, for example. They've softened on pretty much all that stuff. The policies are not as arcane as they once were. But I mean, there are still some issues, and you know, there's different things. Like, for example, you can download the eBay app or the Amazon app and buy goods and services through those apps, and and Apple doesn't take a 30% cut. But if it's content being sold, then Apple takes 30% cut. And 30% cut of ongoing subscriptions is a little high. We've talked about that before. It's a little too much. And certainly would think that Apple will hopefully revisit that again, because I think even 15% is too much.
What do you think the right number is?
I don't think that they should have a cut of sales in perpetuity, especially if the service being provided is all hosted by, you know, Spotify or whoever. I mean, if you're paying for a Microsoft Office subscription, for example, and you buy it through iTunes, does Apple deserve to get a 30% cut of that forever?
It's a valid question. What do you think the counter argument is?
Well, the counter argument is Apple has to maintain the servers, and they serve up a lot of apps that are free or freemium. And for them to maintain the quality of the App Store and the review process and all that costs money. There's upkeep, and they have to make money. So that's where they're going to take their pound of flesh, so to speak. I understand where Apple's coming from. I just don't think ongoing 30% cut or even a 15% cut is fair when Apple at that point is not really involved in it at all.
I, Wonder of Wonders, actually had a story this week that we published. Do you remember what it was?
You talked about how we do this podcast.
I talked about how we do this podcast. So this is the ultimate in navel gazing, I suppose. But as our listeners know and are welcome to remind me, we have had some hiccups in our quality over the year. And we've made a lot of progress towards getting better about that. And the process that we use right now is sort of multi-layered, right? It's multifaceted with a lot of different apps. We start by using Zencastr, or sometimes Skype, but today we opened up Zencastr and started Zencastr, and we've been using Zencastr's voice over IP to hold this call. Well, I should back up a step. What microphone are you using?
I am using the iRig Studio.
Right, and that's a mic that has a number of different connections. You can use it with Lightning, you can use it with USB. You're using it with USB because Lightning audio isn't quite perfect for these kind of calls.
Lightning audio does not work with VoIP or anything like that. It only works with recording apps, but not person-to-person calls because of iOS coding weirdness. It's annoying because I would love to do this podcast on my iPad Pro, because this is exactly the type of task that an iPad, I think, is great for, where I don't want a million things in my face. I want to be able to focus on what we're talking about. I want to be able to focus on the podcast and have all of my attention on it. And I think that's a great use for an iPad. Can't do it.
And it's what's even stranger is that it used to function like this. It used to be possible to do Lightning audio.
Skype used to work with Lightning audio, and then they released an update at some point last year where they switched to the iOS core audio recommendations that Apple has, which defaults to either the built-in microphone, or if you plug in headphones to the headphone jack, it'll default to the microphone on the headphones that you plug in. But there,
and it will also use a Bluetooth source.
Yeah, but there is no way to do a FaceTime audio call, for example, or a Skype call over Lightning. Although I have not tested with iOS 10 yet. Maybe Apple fixed that, but I think that's more of a developer thing than an Apple thing at that point. But Apple's recommended course of action for audio calls person to person is to not use Lightning audio.
So the reason I mention that is that the sound all begins with the microphone. And, you know, you're using a nice microphone. I'm using a microphone. And it turns out my microphone is fairly affordable. My microphone cost $50 on Amazon, and my travel mic that I take with me was $12. And then I get it into the computer using a mic interface from Sentrance, which is a really nice mic interface. I'm very pleased with its sound. And one of the things that I do to compare mic interfaces is that I'll use the same microphone and make sure that I set my levels the same, using Audacity to monitor my levels. And just switching out the mic interfaces, I can tell which ones have different sounds to them and whether or not they introduced more noise into the signal. So from there, we go into Zencastr. Now, Zencastr is currently a web application that runs in Firefox and Chrome. And I've asked and inquired, and I'm going to say it without having asked permission to say it, but he's looking into, it's on his roadmap to make it a mobile application so that it'll work in iOS Safari.
Awesome.
which would be brilliant. And the cool thing about Zencastr is that it's very, very good at what it does. It has VoIP. It allows you to invite people to a call that the host sets up. You can have a chat. You can have footnotes. The chat doesn't persist after the call is over, but the footnotes can a little bit, so you can use those as references for your show notes. And it saves the audio locally to HTML5 cache and then uploads it after the show is done recording. And then it will upload those files to Dropbox as well. The cool thing about it is that it has a post-processing feature that uses Auphonic. Auphonic is brilliant. Auphonic is a website, it's an iOS app, it's a standalone desktop app, it's a ton of things. In all of those cases, it uses the same good post-production to make our levels the same. If my levels are different than Neil's and they're a little bit higher or a little bit lower, it adjusts them. Last week when we recorded, Neil, you told me after we were done that my levels were terrible, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
They were all wrong, weren't they?
They were way too low, yeah.
Yeah. You listened to the show, did you?
Yes.
How were they afterwards?
Sounded fine.
Auphonic works. It really does. And I have a lot of respect for George who writes it. And the different applications are very different in terms of capability. The web app has the most amount of features in it. It does things like taking text files that say where the chapters are and being able to put them into the web and have it spit out a MP3 that has chapter markers and it's suitable for Overcast. It's a huge Swiss Army knife tool for that stuff. It does everything. You can even use it to process the audio for movie files. If you have an MP4 that you put into it, you'll get back a movie with good audio. It's incredible. The desktop app is a lot more limited. You feed it two multi-track files, you get back one file and adjusts it. It's very simple in that regard, but it works. The mobile app has a button on it that you can tap to mark where the chapter markers need to go. So there are a number of different things going on there that make them all slightly different, but they're all very capable. They're wonderful. Now, one of the things that one of our readers commented on, our listeners commented on, it was that sometimes the amount of space between when I speak or Neil speaks is either too much or too little. And there are a number of different timing issues going on here. First of all, there's latency over the internet, right? How fast is your internet connection, Neil?
Pretty fast, actually. I get about over 50 to 60 down and usually about 15 to 20 up.
Okay. I have 350 down and 25 to 30 up.
That's pretty good.
I do okay. And you know, someday I hope for that number to increase. But right now, it's 350 down. So there's latency over the internet, even though we both have very good internet connections, because even though our down is good, our up is a fraction of that. So that's one part that plays into it. Another part that plays into it is the timing. You know, all of this is done by chips that have clocks in them, and my MacBook Pro's clock is not exactly the same as the clock inside Neil's MacBook Pro. And so those timings can get out of sync. And another thing that takes place is when I adjust, it's also the VoIP connection, because just the nature of the VoIP connection is such that we could be overlapping by a little bit if we're not careful. But knowing that we leave pauses between some of these things, I go ahead and take it to an application called Ferrite. And Ferrite is brilliant. Ferrite was written by a fellow in England, and it's wonderful. And one of the features that I asked him about, he was already working on. And that is the ability to tighten. One of the things that he does is that he allows you to detect silence and then strip the silence out. But when I did that using Ferrite early on, it left all these gaps where the silence had been. And so I asked him, how can I compact all of that? And he said, well, there's a feature called Tighten. And Tighten tightens up the audio file by getting rid of those silences. And it allows you to adjust how much or how little silence you leave in. And it works great, except that sometimes I'm not as sensitive with those adjustments as I should be, either taking out too much and we're speaking one after the other, stepping on each other's sentences, or by leaving too much gaps in. So I apologize to your listeners. That's something I'm working on, but that's where that comes from, is my adjustment, not the tools. The tools are wondrous. And after Ferrite, I take it to SoundCloud and publish. So I go through, four different applications: Zencastr, Auphonic, Ferrite. Oh, and I left out the one. Sometimes we get requests for chapter markers. Overcast, some of the other podcatcher apps that people listen through use chapter markers. And so sometimes it's when it's easy for me to figure out where the chapters should go, I will open up an application by another fellow. I think his name is Thomas Pritchard, forgive me, wrote Podcast Chapters, which is in the Mac App Store, and is very well laid out. And I put the audio file in that. I press Command N each time there's a new chapter, and you know this result is that I have to listen to the podcast again. I end up listening to the podcast during the course of this, generally two times, maybe three.
I'm sorry.
For the whole production. And the one of the nice things about Podcast Chapters is, besides how what else it does as well, it allows you to speed up the playback. So I can listen at 1.5 times or 2 times and be able to pick out where the chapters go just a little bit faster. And then I take it to SoundCloud and publish. And we've arrived at this because early on, as you know, the quality wasn't what I really wanted it to be. It wasn't representative of what you can do here. And trying to just get the sound quality up goes a long way towards helping you hear the ideas we're talking about.
And that's how the sausage gets made.
Thanks for indulging me. Speaking of sausage and stuff like that and the nitty-gritty and getting stuff to work, you were trying to work through a GitHub project recently.
So I wasted a few hours this week. I have finally gotten to a point where smart home accessories are cheap enough and prevalent enough and advanced enough that it seems like I can go beyond my Hue bulbs and maybe dig a little deeper and get the smart home of my dreams. I'm about to move to a new place, and so I'm kind of planning out what I want to do there and how I want to implement things and that sort of stuff. And HomeKit is growing, and what it does is growing, and the accessories that connect to it, the number of those are growing, but it's still not quite there yet. So
wait, let me stop you right there. What's your ideal smart home? What is the smart home of your dreams?
Well, I want to be able to control the things that I have in my house that I would want to not only be able to control while in the house, but also away from it. So logical things, air conditioning, controlling the television would be fantastic. I don't know what channel anything is. I got 800 frickin' channels. I don't know. You know, I don't know where CNBC is if I want to watch it. And if I try to tell my Xbox to change it to CNBC, it puts on CMT, Country Music Television. So
that's a voice reco problem.
Well, that's just an Xbox One problem because it's a piece of crap. I want to be able to get to a point where I can have a scene. Like right now I have a scene. There are two Hue bulbs. I have a projector in my current apartment. And I have two Hue bulbs that turn off with the scene of watch TV and allows the projector to be seen adequately. What I would like to have is, say, watch TV and have it turn on all the necessary devices, the projector, the Xbox, the cable box, etc.
Turn off
the lights, everything else. And then I should be able to say, watch this channel. And then some connected device would be able to automatically change the channel and everything would work with my voice. And I wouldn't have to use a remote and flip through the guide because I'm not a channel flipper. I just don't like doing that. So I want to get to that point. And there is a service. It's a GitHub project called Homebridge that allows you to take connected devices that are not necessarily HomeKit compliant and control them with Siri on your phone. I wasted about 3 hours yesterday on it, and I say wasted because I didn't get anything to work, unfortunately. But I'm going to continue to dig at it. If anybody who's listening has any experience with Homebridge and might be able to help me out, it would be much appreciated. But I wanted to just test it out. You can run it in two ways. You can run it in OS X on your Mac and have that act as a server for Homebridge and your Mac needs to be on. Or what I would eventually like to do is you can do it on a Raspberry Pi and just have that sitting somewhere in your house and always connecting. So it acts as a server for Homebridge, connects to your Wi-Fi network, allows you to use your iPhone or whatever other device to use Siri to control things.
The truth is that this is really a Node.js kind of software.
Yes.
And It runs on a number of things. It runs on a free NAS. It runs on Windows. It runs on OS X. It runs on Raspberry Pi. It runs on a bunch of things. I'm thinking about running this on my router.
That would be cool.
You know, if you have a Synology router or a Synology NAS, for example, clearly you're able to run things on those. They have their own app store.
It's very hacked together. And the more you try to do with it, from what I've read, the more likely it is to break, with as it is with any hack project. You install plugins for the devices that you want to control. So the one that I was trying to test out before I get a little more advanced in this, and I couldn't get it to work, unfortunately, was a Siri HomeKit plugin for iTunes on my Mac. And so what it would allow me to do is to tell Siri to play an artist, a playlist, whatever, but also to dictate which of my AirPlay speakers I want it to play on. I have a set of AirPlay speakers at my desk. I have a set in the kitchen. I have some in the bedroom. And then I have a Denon receiver that is
Denon.
I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyhow, a Denon receiver in my living area with the projector that also is an AirPlay compliant device. Now, it would be really nice to be able to tell my phone to play an artist on a certain speaker, but Siri and HomeKit don't have that level of control, and that is where Homebridge comes in. So Homebridge has plugins for things like iTunes. It has a plugin for my Denon receiver because it's a Wi-Fi connected receiver, so it'll turn it on. It has a plugin to turn on an Xbox One over IP. It has plugins to control all kinds of devices and can also bridge smart home platforms between each other. So, for example, you could, in theory, use your iPhone and Siri to control a Logitech Harmony Hub, which is an infrared blaster, which then controls a number of devices, like, for example, the things I was talking about controlling, projector, Xbox, cable box, etc. That is potentially bridging the gap and creating scenes and adding devices to HomeKit that normally would not operate with HomeKit. Because as it stands right now, there is no HomeKit protocol for infrared blaster, television, that sort of stuff. So that's the kind of smart home controls that I really want, because especially when you have a complex home theater setup, right? It's just a nightmare to get everything working, to get it all turned to the right input and on and all that kind of stuff. And there's a bunch of remotes and you're just flipping. That's
right. All the stuff that Harmony's known for.
That is the kind of thing that I would really like to see simplified with voice, where I can just tell my TV to turn it to a certain channel or whatever. But then there's also, you know, like remote control of things like, your temperature. That's another area where I have an issue, because apparently nobody makes a window-mounted HomeKit air conditioner. So my options there are either to use a smart plug, which would turn the air conditioner on and off, but that doesn't give me any ability to set the temperature or anything like that. I could basically just tell it to turn the AC on or off when I leave my apartment or whatever. Or, you know, I don't know what my other options would be to make it work. Maybe Homebridge could find some sort of way, if there's a Wi-Fi connected AC unit that it would work with. Maybe there's a plug-in for it or something. But that's the kind of stuff that I want to be able to do as I envision my dream smartphone home.
Yeah, you won't like it, but there are plug-ins for Tado.
See, I couldn't get that to work properly, especially with the AC unit I had at my old apartment, where it would have to go through, like, 30 degrees of temperature to get to the right one. So just go beep, 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 beep. It was awful. So Tado does make a smart AC control infrared blaster. And they've said that they have HomeKit compatibility coming, but a lot of products have advertised HomeKit compatibility and don't have it. Like the Chinese brand Haier, H-A-I-E-R. Am I pronouncing that one right?
You are.
They announced in September of 2015 HomeKit connected window mounted AC unit, and it has yet to ship from everything that I can find. If you Google it, the only thing you can really find is a press release about it. So, you know, I don't know when these products are coming. At WWDC a couple weeks ago, Apple had a long list of companies that are making HomeKit products, and Haier was among those up there. So
I'm just looking at that image again.
Yeah, they're on the right side.
Tado's on that image, by the way.
Yeah. Tado's on there, Haier's on there. These are companies that pledge support but have yet to ship anything. So I know D-Link is planning on shipping out an updated version of their camera that will be HomeKit compatible. Mm-hmm. And who's the other camera company? They have one coming as well.
Well, we know that First Alert's camera will be on that list, and we know that the August camera for their doorbell.
And I think the Canary as well is...
Canary's on the list, yes, which is awesome.
Yeah, so, you know, it's coming, but... For example, I'm going to be in the next couple of months in the market to buy a window-mounted AC unit for my new place, and I really want to get something that I can control with HomeKit so I can have the temperature go up a little bit when I leave, save some electricity, be able to turn it down before I get home. So when I get home, it's nice and cool in my place, you know, that sort of stuff. And we're not there yet. There are some hacks, you know, I could use some smart plugs. I could do some things here and there to kind of act as a interim for it. But HomeBridge is one of those things that I'm really excited about and hoping to get working specifically for controlling my home theater.
Well, HomeBridge, let's be clear, is a patch for you until official support is provided, right?
Right. And I don't know that Apple's in a rush to ever provide official support for home theater.
Well, no, but if Logitech, just for example, wanted to.
But are there the proper calls within HomeKit that Apple allows? Because don't forget, they had to expand the abilities of the API with iOS 10 to add things like doorbell cameras and...
cameras were not in the original plan. Originally, the original spec was that you had door locks, fans, garage door openers, lights, outlets, thermostats, and now cameras, right? And you get to define... The Apple-defined characteristic types are brightness, door state, locked or unlocked, temperature, lock state, you know, locked or unlocked kind of thing, or door state was open-close, power state on-off, rotation speed, which speed, direction of rotation, the target door state, the target state of these kinds of things, and the target temperature, mm-hmm. right? And that covers a decent amount of stuff, but as you say, it doesn't cover home theater. But... what I forget is those are the Apple-defined service types and states. The question is, can you define your own in your own application to augment that?
Well, like, for example, the Elgato Eve Room is yes. a product that does things that HomeKit doesn't necessarily allow for. Like, for example, it can tell the quality of the air.
I'm opening my Eve app right now.
Right. Now, there's a number of problems with that device. Number one, it connects over Bluetooth to your phone, so you have to kind of be within range of it and stuff like that. But number two, you can't do anything with the information from it. HomeKit doesn't allow you to connect things. So, for example, one potential solution if HomeKit were able to do it would be to have a smart plug on a window AC unit and then separately have a temperature sensor that is also HomeKit connected. And I could say, if the temperature goes below 74 degrees, turn on the smart plug and activate the air conditioner to cool it down to 72 or whatever, right?
So what Apple has are they have action sets and they have time-based triggers, right? That's how the rules are constructed for trying to do device interaction stuff. You can have an action set where multiple things are going to happen at once based on a timer, or you can have a timer trigger that specifies the time for event to happen. And
location-based stuff as well, if you leave.
How optionally it recurs and things like that. But they don't have device chaining kind of things the way if this then that does, for example.
And there's a delay with if this then that of about 15 minutes, so... For things like if you want to keep your temperature regulated in your apartment and save energy and you don't necessarily have a smart device for it, then HomeKit is not the solution for that. And if this, then that won't be as responsive as you'd want.
So there's room for improvement here. But we haven't seen it all yet because still iOS 10 is still early days.
Yeah, there's a lot of room for improvement. There need to be more accessories. The fact that I can't find a window AC unit when, you know, a large... portion of the population lives in cities and has window AC units without central air. You would think that there would be a market for that. So I'm hoping that something hits the market soon and does what I'm looking for, because I'm in the market to buy one. And if anybody out there is listening and knows of one that I haven't been able to find, it's kind of the Wild West right now with HomeKit. A lot of companies announced support and then realized there was a hardware component of it that they couldn't meet. And then, so they never actually shipped. And that's kind of where you have that list from WWDC with a bunch of manufacturers on it that never shipped HomeKit products. When are these things coming out? What are they going to make? We don't really know yet. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of those cameras that were announced at WWDC don't even ship this year, just the way that HomeKit launch is gone.
Well, but all of the rough spots of needing the hardware and stuff like that were last year's problems. So I would expect these ones would go smoother.
Maybe.
Now, I'm just looking at... So I've got the Eve and I've got a Withings Home over there, and they both measure air quality in parts per millions. And the... Eve says that my air quality is excellent at 514 parts per million, and my home says that it's 450. And so I'm not sure what the discrepancy is. Oh, there's the echo from the home speaker. Sorry about that. It's got a microphone on it, and so it's picking me up speaking and then playing it back through the iPhone. I apologize. But it's interesting to me that these things pick up different readings like that when they're in the same room. The Withings Home product is not HomeKit, because, of course, HomeKit didn't have cameras until now. But the Eve stuff is. Now, Bluetooth, like you said, is an interesting choice. And I would venture to say, this is my opinion, that Apple's support of Bluetooth in HomeKit is not where their attention is. Their attention is on things that are Wi-Fi or things that use a bridge to talk to Ethernet.
Right.
And that they have Bluetooth in the spec, but that they really didn't give it the love that we think of.
Right.
Apple giving things. All of Elgato's products are Bluetooth HomeKit in this path. Some of the other people doing similar products, not the same products, but some of them similar, are using Bluetooth and Wi-Fi in the same product. And that can make a difference just in terms of connectivity between, you know, all of the devices.
Right.
But the Bluetooth stuff does work, and you know, it does follow the spec. I have the Apple TV 4 and am able to see what the Eve is reading when I'm outside the home by virtue of the Bluetooth in the Eve talking to the Apple TV.
Right. Yeah, the groundwork's there for a lot of this stuff. It's just not as I'm looking to invest in it more seriously beyond the light bulbs that I have. It's coming up short, and
you just want Logitech to get on the stick.
Well, I'd like to be able to control my home theater, but I want to be able to control my AC, and we're not there yet. The products that I've tested just aren't really that good, that reliable, or they just aren't HomeKit compatible. And I want to be able to, especially with iOS 10 and the Home app and integration into Control Center. I mean, I want to be able to just hit a button on there that says watch TV. And, you know, if I have a screen for my projector that's on a motor, it comes down, the projector turns on, the cable box turns on, the lights go off.
Yep, the action set.
Why not? I mean, that's so many things to do at once, but that's a task that you would do regularly. That's really where a smart home excels. It's like when voice dictation and Siri first came out. Siri was great for complex tasks, like saying, you know, create a reminder to tell me tomorrow at 10 o'clock to empty the dishwasher or something like that, right? I mean, that's something that right. If you were to do that, you would have to open your phone, open the reminders app, create a new reminder, put 10 o'clock, type in empty the dishwasher, save it. I mean, it's such a complex thing with so many steps that voice command saves you so much time. There are other examples where it doesn't necessarily save you time and voice commands don't really make a lot of sense. But, you know, for stuff like smart homes where you have multiple actions at once for scenes where you can say goodnight and it turns off all your lights, for example, or you come home and things just automatically turn on without having to talk to it, location-based stuff, that's where the future of smart home is, and that's where it needs to be going. It needs to greatly expand the number of connected devices beyond light bulbs and shades and air quality measure things.
Well, I think back to when we talked with Carly Knobloch of Home Garden Television and her own blog, Carly K. You know, she said that the future of this is all of these things making stuff more convenient for
right.
you, right? That's what it comes down to. Is the shades matter if you're sitting at the kitchen table and blinded by the sun at noon,
right?
But if you don't have that problem, then it's not a solution you need. So it's about having enough of the equipment out there to make all of these things come together to make your life, Neil Hughes, more convenient.
One day. I'm holding out hope. I'm hoping soon, because I'm going to have to buy stuff soon for my new place.
I want to see pictures of the new place. This has been the Diamond Jubilee episode of the Apple Insider Podcast. I'm your host, Victor. Neil, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, if you want to read what I have to write, it's at appleinsider.com, and you can find me on Twitter at thisisneil, N-E-I-L. And if you have any HomeKit recommendations or advice on how to set up HomeBridge, I am all ears.
I'm Victor. I'm at vmarks on Twitter. This has been another episode of the Apple Insider Podcast. And if Neil cuts playing cards in half to figure out the size of the original iPhone battery, we'll all hear about it next week on the Apple Insider Podcast.